You are listening to another No Fair Remembering Stuff, the Tuesday edition of the Professional Left Podcast, and available wherever you get your podcasts, and at our website, proleftpod.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a Patreon button at that website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at the Professional Left Podcast, P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
And it's not safe for work.
Blue Gal, it has been said, and rightly so, that the very weakest, most C-minus high school book report way to start any presentation is by reading the dictionary definition of the keywords you're going to use. Well, of course, we will not be doing that today.
We're higher quality than that, Driftglass.
Much higher. We put a lot more effort into this thing than that kind of crap. So instead, we will be turning to the Wikipedia definition of Palinism, which defines Palinism as, quote, U.S. political figure Sarah Palin, or a statement or turn of phrase used by U.S. public figure Sarah Palin that is unintentionally comical due to malapropisms, dubious coherency, etc., unquote.
Because we started blogging, you know, a dog's age ago in 2004 and you in 2005.
Yep.
I mean, this is my 20-year anniversary this year.
I know. This year, baby.
In November of this year. And that was the height of the Bush administration. We fell in love during the Bush administration, Driftglass. Something, you know, some at least one thing good came out of that era. But we have archives that date back to well before Sarah Palin ever showed up on the national radar.
Yeah.
We didn't know who Sarah Palin was. Maybe that's why we were so happy and carefree. So instead of seeing Palin as this singular black swan event that landed on the political stage, we can see her as a logical choice of a political party that fully understood its own political base and what that base wanted to see up there on stage. And they did not want to see Joe Lieberman.
No.
The Republican base appreciated the fact that Lieberman had helped sabotage the Gore campaign in 2000. But to them, to that Republican base, Holy Joe was just a useful turncoat, not vice presidential material. The 2012 docudrama Game Change about the 2008 election covers the McCain campaign's vice presidential dilemma accurately. Inserted into the movie are actual news clips. See if you can spot Newt Gingrich and Sean Hannity's voices here.
He wants Lieberman on the ticket.
Of course he does.
Disaster.
Or historic
disaster.
John loves him. That'd be a strong move towards bipartisanship.
Guys, the base is already concerned that John is not a true conservative. And I don't think picking a pro-choice Jewish Democrat who just happened to be Al Gore's running mate is going to alleviate that concern.
Maybe we have McCain make a one-term pledge. He announces in some huge speech that he and a Democrat are joining together for one term so that the parties can come together and solve this country's greatest problems.
Maybe, with a one-term pledge.
Nothing says country first like picking Joe Lieberman.
Well, if it's gonna work, it has to remain absolutely secret right up until the convention. If it gets leaked, the right will kill it.
John McCain's decision to put Joe Lieberman front and center at his convention has the unique distinction of unsettling both Democrats and Republicans.
I think the idea of him being the Republican vice presidential nominee would split the convention.
In the cabinet, fine, not as VP. Bad choice, conservatives will bolt.
Comedy team of McCain and Lieberman. Maybe they'll play Atlantic City this summer.
Years of drooling over hot women in short skirts on Fox, who at the same time were talking trash about Democrats, had created for them their fantasy woman. And Monica Crowley on the McLaughlin Group went right over the top about Sarah Palin.
Question, is Sarah Palin too good to be true?
She is Anne Margaret in Kitten with a Whip. She is fabulous, okay? And it raises the question, where has she been? The Republican Party has been craving somebody new and fresh and dynamic.
Now, Sarah Palin didn't appear out of nowhere. This was all thanks to a guy named Bill Kristol, who would these days very much appreciate it if everyone could kind of forget that this ever happened. But it happened. And this is from the Daily Beast, October 10th, my brother's birthday, by the way, 2008. Quote, Palin's talent scout. No wonder Bill Kristol has remained so positive about her while other neocons have fled. He helped push her to the VP ticket and won out against Karl Rove. Imagine that. In June of 2007, a cruise hosted by the political journal The Weekly Standard set anchor in Juneau, Alaska. Standard editors William Kristol and Fred Barnes then lunched with Governor Sarah Palin. It was a moment of discovery to equal Hernando Cortez's landing at Veracruz. The Daily Telegraph's Tim Shipman saw this encounter as the launch of a neoconservative project surrounding Palin. He interviewed a former Republican White House official now at the American Enterprise Institute about Palin. She's bright, and she's a blank page. She's going places, and it's worth going there with her. Asked if he sees her as a project, the former official said, "Your word, not mine, but I wouldn't disagree with the sentiment." Kristol appeared on Fox News on June 30th, 2008, confidently predicting that McCain would select Sarah Palin as a public display of support, and then oil prices would miraculously fall.
Because Kristol's magic.
Because magic, because Kristol's wrong about everything. Kristol can fairly lay claim to having discovered Palin for Washington political circles. Palin's name appeared in 41 Weekly Standard articles since the Juneau meeting, starting with a paean entitled The Most Popular Governor that ran right after the reception. The inner circle broke between two choices. Those close to Karl Rove, united around Mitt Romney. Rove engaged in heavy lobbying in an effort to get McCain to embrace Romney. Others, of whom Kristol was the most prominent, pushed Sarah Palin, arguing that she was young, popular, vigorous, unknown, and had the right connections to the religious right bloc, which had proved so important to Republican wins in 2000 and 2004, unquote. And so, ladies and gentlemen, in 2008, may I announce...
To help me fight the same old Washington politics of me first and country second, my friends and fellow Americans, I am very pleased and very privileged to introduce to you the next Vice President of the United States... Governor Sarah Palin of the great state of Alaska.
When it became almost immediately apparent that Palin was completely unqualified for the job, almost all of the grandees of conservative media reacted very badly to her nomination. And this right here was when the GOP civil war that had been boiling just under the surface for decades really broke into the open for the first time. Yep. From the Daily Beast again, quote, after the nomination, conservative columnists have been very critical of the Palin candidacy. Some have openly distanced themselves from it, such as National Review's Kathleen Parker, who called on Palin voluntarily to quit the ticket. David Brooks referred to Palin as a cancer on the Republican Party. Peggy Noonan was overheard grumbling about the choice as political bullshit on an open mic on MSNBC. George Will told a gathering of Senate aides that Palin was obviously not qualified to be vice president. Former presidential speechwriter David Frum called the choice a gamble and then said he felt it was disturbing. Charles Krauthammer called the choice near suicidal, unquote.
So, to be clear, that was one side of the fight. On the other side, there was Bill Kristol, who'd gone all in on Palin and was not about to back down, you know, just like the Iraq War. If we just have the will to do it, we can win it. This is back to the Daily Beast. Quote, Kristol's one of the few conservative columnists whose support of Palin has been unflinching. He has used his space as a New York Times columnist to tout her candidacy repeatedly. But in the process, Kristol has never bothered to disclose his role in the decision-making process that led to the Palin pick. Kristol's Weekly Standard has figured as Palin's chief defender. and its writers have gone after even those who dare pose questions about Palin's candidacy. Bill Kristol, it seems, has much at stake in the Palin candidacy, unquote. This is from Richard Viguerie. This is the guy who pioneered political direct mail and has been called by many people one of the creators of the modern conservative movement. This is him talking about Palin as if she were the savior of conservatism. This is from him in August of 2008. She, quote, unites the GOP, gives conservatives a stake in the election, and puts a real reformer on the ticket. This is a grand slam home run. Conservatives' feet haven't touched the ground since this announcement, unquote. And then there was the editor of the National Review, Rich Lowry, and his little starburst comments about the October 3rd, 2008 vice presidential debate between Joe Biden and Sarah Palin, during which Biden crushed Palin. Hang on, folks. If you haven't heard this one in a while, it's wild.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, this is Rich Lowry. I'm sure I'm not the only male in America who, when Palin dropped her first wink, sat up a little straighter on the couch and said, hey, I think she just winked at me. And her smile. By the end, when she clearly knew she was doing well, it was so sparkling, it almost mesmerizing. It sent little starbursts through the screen and ricocheting around the living rooms in America. This is a quality that can't be learned. It's either something you have or you don't. And man, she's got it. Unquote. Letters to Penthouse from Rich Lowry.
And a public service announcement. Professional left listeners who would like to spend 7 whole days on an Alaska cruise with Rich Starburst Lowry can join him on the National Review Institute cruise. It is June 16th to 23rd, 2024. Drift Class, I have the website for this cruise open. They are going to feature their, by popular demand, 3-part Burke to Buckley seminar on the boat.
Because that's when conservative history, we'd rather stop talking about it.
Stop
Thank you
talking
very much.
About it with Bill Buckley. That's
if we
right.
Could just, if we could just all quit around 1964, that'd be great. If we could all
that'd
just
be great.
Because after that, it's just yada, yada, Reagan, yeah. Yada, yada, Obama, and then, you know, whatever.
They've got Rich Lowry, Noah Rothman, and Elizabeth Edwards Spaulding, and Matthew Spaulding, all on the same boat for a week.
Wow. How do we sink that boat, Blue Gal?
They also are having seminars on communism versus socialism and free market economics.
Wow.
Along with a whale watch. So, you know, you get it all. So, and a public service announcement, but we thought you ought to know that you could spend 7 whole days on Dante's Fifth Circle of Hell cruise with the National Review.
Let's just say if you're a good poker player and are looking for a place to strip a lot of chumps of their spare change, there's a boatload of them going to be available to you. Just show up and go, I'm not sure how to play this game. Maybe you could just
And we're going to get into a little bit of the history of this later in the show, but on this cruise, you do get to meet the governor of Alaska.
Oh,
it just happens to not be Sarah Palin anymore.
Oh, I thought, where's Sarah Palin? I got this.
It's
on
Mike Dunleavy.
Oh, great.
And they're going to have a private reception with him. So there you go.
Maybe we'll see
Mike Dunleavy on the Republican ticket someday.
He does not give me starbursts up my pants.
But he won't give you starbursts or Rich Lowry starbursts. No, he will not. Okay, we're done with that. Palin's fall in 2008 was so fast that less than 3 weeks later, George Packer was writing Conservatism's Political Obituary in The New Yorker, October 23rd, 2008. Mm-hmm. Like, this is 2 weeks before the election, less than 2 weeks.
Oh, this is, this is less than 3 weeks after Rich Lowry felt those starbursts go up his leg.
Yeah, this is just quick. Quote, step back a moment from the robocalls and the Biden gaffes and the Valentino jacket to take in the history being made as we watch. And the Valentino jacket was something that the Republican Party bought for Sarah Palin to wear on the campaign trail. Mm-hmm. And it was a scandal. I don't mean the likelihood of a Black American president, though that's mind-bending enough. I'm referring to the complete collapse of the 4-decade project that brought conservatism to power in America. You're not going to hear that on the National Review Institute cruise, I promise
you.
No. As for Palin, this again, this is George Packer in The New Yorker, 2008. As for Palin, the incarnation of red meat, know-nothing Christian nationalism, she turns out to be McCain's single biggest mistake. The Republican Party's immediate post-election future will be a bloody struggle over Palinism. It's already started at National Review Online, where the growing hysteria of the posts signals that the roof is falling in on conservatism. Everything that worked for 40 years has suddenly just stopped working. And not just stopped working, it has become self-defeating. Republican candidates, strategists, and pundits are like witch doctors who keep repeating the old incantations over and over, their voices rising in furious shock to no effect. That's the sound of an era ending, unquote. But there was also the ever-reliable Holy Joe Lieberman, more than happy to jump in to prop Palin up.
Make our country...
Is she smarter than Joe Biden?
I'm not going to... Yeah, but this is...
Come on, look, you know Joe Biden. You're supporting Sarah Palin. I want to hear Senator. I want to hear.
But this is not an IQ test. She's plenty smart, and Joe Biden is plenty smart.
But, you know, I have to try one more time. Is she smarter than Joe Biden? You know Joe Biden, and she's going for the vice presidential position.
No, but that's not...
You don't think that's important?
They're both plenty smart enough to do this job. The question.
So it was a very bad decision. In fact, in the Rolling Stones' 50 Worst Decisions of the Past 50 Years in American Politics, John McCain picking Sarah Palin as his running mate comes in as the 11th worst political decision in the last half century. So way to go.
That's like a few below several Vietnam ones, I imagine.
Yeah, it's Nixon. It's very bad. It's very, very bad. It's above Blagojevich, okay?
It's bad.
Here's the quote. John McCain knew he needed to make a big move in the summer of 2008. Barack Obama was firing up liberals who were desperate to take back the White House after 8 years of George W. Bush. McCain's initial impulse was to send shockwaves through the system by picking Joe Lieberman as his running mate. They were longtime best friends, and McCain thought he could sell it since Lieberman had left the Democratic Party 2 years earlier. But Lieberman was still pro-choice, and he was still Al Gore's former running mate. This simply wasn't going to fly with the Republican Party. It would have led to a nasty floor battle at the convention. Without much time on the clock, McCain decided instead to select Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, who, let us remember, was shoved on him by a guy named Bill Kristol, despite knowing little about her or her background. As we all remember, this didn't work out well for him in the long run. Palin simply wasn't ready for the spotlight, and it became a huge distraction for McCain in the final weeks of his doomed campaign, unquote. So, very, very bad decision, right? But one which made it very clear, if you were paying attention, that conservative elites did, in fact, understand the nature of the base they had created. They knew who these people were, and they kind of knew what they wanted. A party that was ready and eager for someone who spoke in the language they had already been hearing every day on hate radio and on Fox News for decades. Someone who could casually talk like this.
Our opponent is someone who sees America as imperfect enough to pal around with terrorists who targeted their own country.
The only question was, exactly how much appeasement did that base require? And when making that calculation, the lesson of Kathleen Parker wasn't lost on anyone. Kathleen Parker is a Washington Post conservative columnist who spent her entire career lobbing red meat to the insane, bitey-bitey conservative zombies. Then she wrote a less-than-supporting column about Sarah Palin. Mm-hmm. She was suddenly and hilariously shocked to discover that her readers were not just insane, bitey-bitey conservative zombies, because she'd been writing for them for years, but they were insane, bitey-bitey conservative zombies who super-duper loved them some Sarah Palin.
Mm-hmm.
So this is from her September 30th, 2008, again, mere weeks before the election.
Yep.
Column detailing the reaction of those violently insane, bitey-bitey conservative zombies. This is her audience.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, Allow me to introduce myself. I am a traitor and an idiot. Also, my mother should have aborted me and left me in a dumpster, but since she didn't, I should off myself. After 20 years of column writing, I'm familiar with angry mail, but the past few days have produced responses of a different order, not just angry, but vicious and threatening, unquote.
Yep.
Didn't she know?
Never occurred to her. As long as they were directing that rage and violence and threatening
at Barack Obama.
At Barack Obama and liberals.
Yeah.
They didn't notice or
care.
She
didn't hear it. She didn't hear it. That's the case. Yep.
They were attacking the bad communist people, not the good patriot people.
Yep. But don't worry about Ms. Parker. She recovered from that brief collision with reality and managed by dint of sheer batshit talking point repetition to slither back into the good graces of the insane bitey-bitey conservative zombie crowd. Even after the McCain-Palin ticket crashed and burned, Bill Kristol understood where the Republican center of gravity was now located. This is from Bill Kristol's October 27, 2009 Washington Post column. That's right. He was now at the Washington Post. Quote, Kristol, GOP's future center of gravity lies with Beck, Limbaugh. Obviously, many Republicans and conservatives and lots of moderates and independents will be grateful to Mitch McConnell if he can stop Obamacare, and to John Kyle if he can induce the president to embrace a stronger foreign policy. But it's unlikely that the minority party in Congress will be the source of bold new conservative leadership over the next 3 years. Even if Republicans pick up the House in 2010, the party's big ideas and themes for the 2012 presidential race will probably not emanate from Capitol Hill. You think?
Mm-hmm.
The center of gravity, I expect, will instead lie with individuals such as Palin and Huckabee and Gingrich, media personalities like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, and activists at town halls and tea parties.
Mm-hmm.
Some will lament this, but over the past year, as those voices have dominated, conservatism has done pretty well in the body politic, and Republicans have narrowed the gap with Democrats in test ballots. It doesn't matter what we stand for, we're going to win.
And just sit with that for a minute.
Yeah.
Because Bill Kristol, all the way back in 2009, is telling anyone who will listen that he understands perfectly well what's going on in the Republican Party, and he's completely cool with it. As long as we win, if Beck and Limbaugh and Gingrich and Palin are the face and voice of the party, if the Tea Party is the muscle and gristle of the party, he has no problem with that, because at least people like Bill Kristol will be driving the boat, right?
Right.
At least
right.
He will be. And we're going to detour for just a second into Bill Kristol land, because Bill Kristol should not exist in a healthy society. Bill Kristol,
and without Bill Kristol, there would be no Sarah Palin.
There's no Sarah Palin. There's absolutely no Sarah Palin. Without him bringing the full might of the Weekly Standard and all of his other credentials to bear on pushing her into John McCain's lap, there is no Sarah Palin. So the alert listener might be amused to hear that the reason that this was from an October 2009 Washington Post column by Bill Kristol is because Bill Kristol had been fired by the New York Times in January of 2009 after working there for less than a year, about a year. I mean, you know, David Brooks has been there 20 years. Yeah. Kristol lasted 1 year and they sacked his ass. And the reason he was available to be hired by the New York Times in the first place is that in January of 2008 is because in January of 2007, he'd been gifted an opinion column gig at Time Magazine by his dear close personal friend, Richard Stengel, who's Time Magazine managing editor. Time Magazine and Bill Kristol parted company later that year so that he could take the New York Times gig, which Kristol then promptly screwed up, but not just because Bill Kristol's always wrong about everything. I mean, if you think about it, the Times is clearly very comfortable with having its conservative columnists being wrong about almost everything all the time. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the issue. The issue was that Time sacked him, at least in part, because he's a bad and very lazy writer. This is from the Daily Beast, January 26th of 2009. Quote, The New York Times' decision not to renew Bill Kristol's opinion column was because of the conservative writer's sloppiness and uneven quality, according to a reliable source with firsthand knowledge of the decision. I pray that it's David Brooks, but it's probably not. Kristol's writing wasn't compelling or even very careful. He either lacked a talent for solid opinion journalism or wasn't putting his heart into it. A giveaway came in the form of four corrections the newspaper was forced to run over factual mistakes in his column, creating an impression that they were rushed out without due diligence or attention to, you know, factual claims. A senior writer at Time magazine recounted to me a similar experience with Kristol following his stint there in 2006-2007. His conservative ideas were cutting-edge and influential, I was told, but his sloppy writing and failure to fact-check what he wrote made us queasy. Unquote. Yeah, Bill Kristol has a habit of saying shit without finding out if it's true or not, which is how he came to be such a proponent of things like, you know, the Iraq War.
The other problem was that Kristol was so openly contemptuous of his employer. And that's understandable. Everybody has made the New York Times a punching bag, but especially on the right.
But if you work there. Yeah.
And this is again from the Daily Beast, who really made a project out of following Bill Kristol almost as much as Driftglass. Quote, Kristol might still have survived as a columnist had it not been for an attitude of casual and reflexive disloyalty he publicly displayed towards the Times itself. A good example came in an appearance with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show on October 30th. Here's the way editor and publisher described it. Appearing once again on The Daily Show, Bill Kristol, Jon Stewart's favorite whipping boy, Bill Kristol, aren't you ever right? On Thursday night, defended the McCain-Palin ticket, at one point informing the show's host that he was getting his news from suspect sources. You're reading the New York Times too much, John, said Bill Kristol. Bill, you work for the New York Times, Stewart pointed out. That apparently was the last straw for the gray lady.
Yeah.
Unquote. But the real punchline comes in the last sentence of the article. Quote, despite the pink slip, all the news for Kristol is not so grim. The Washington Post has just announced that it will publish Kristol on a monthly basis. I guess they'll need a month to fact check his lazy writing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has the Post made itself into the remainder bin for neocons? Unquote.
Short answer,
signs
yes.
Point to yes.
All signs point to yes, which is why the beginning of this little detour began with Bill Kristol's Washington Post column. What the hell is he doing at the Washington Post? Well, where is he now, though, Blue Gal? Where is he now? Well, Bill Kristol is now an MSNBC regular and one of the publishers of The Bulwark. Now, how is this possible? How is this possible? This is one of the great unanswerable questions of the universe. How is someone with a track record that is uniformly awful able to sort of glide from one media perch to the next for 30 years? No one who knows the answer to this question will dare say it out loud, but we have at least one theory that fits the facts.
I'm telling you, the sky is protected from up on high by the Prince of Darkness. Take my word for it.
Anyway, back in 2008, Kristol was throwing all his weight behind putting Sarah Palin on the ticket next to John McCain. And at almost exactly the same time that Bill Kristol was explaining the Republican Party's new center of gravity, George Will, yes, that George Will, was taking up his quill to write an ooey-gooey love letter to Minnesota's craziest political escapee, Michelle Bachmann. This is from George Will, October 29th, one day before my birthday, 2009. Quote, some of Bachmann's supposed excesses are, however, not merely defensible, they're admirable. For example, her June 9 statement on the House floor in which she spoke of gangster government has been viewed on the internet about 2 million times, unquote, which George Will apparently found very impressive. Clearly, at least some conservative elites were starting to come to terms with the fact that their movement had already been swallowed whole by the yahoos and the bigots that the GOP had spent the last generation recruiting as foot soldiers. They were supposed to be foot soldiers, and now they're running the joint. So if these guys wanted to hang on to their jobs as conservative columnists and Republican Party influencers, they had damn well better learn to cozy up to the unwashed crazy.
And they did.
Yes, they did.
which is why they spent the next 8 years relentlessly slandering Barack Obama and the Democrats in increasingly hysterical and often racist terms. The Yahoos love that shit. And Sarah Palin was right there, still in the vanguard. This is Keith Olbermann in August of 2009. Driftglass, do you remember when it was such a big deal that he was going to have a special comment that night?
I do. Everyone shut up. Everyone tune in.
Yeah, don't forget, Keith is having a special comment tonight. Oh my God. So here is his special comment commenting on Palin's ongoing willingness to lie for her party.
Finally, as promised, a special comment on this terrible moment in American history and those unfortunate and irresponsible Americans who have brought us to it. The America I know and love, the quitter governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, began, is not one in which my parents or my baby with Down syndrome will have to stand in front of Obama's death panel so his bureaucrats can decide based on a subjective judgment of their level of productivity in society whether they are worthy of health care. Such a system is downright evil. Of course it is, Ms. Palin, and that is why it does not exist, has not existed, and would never, under this president, nor any other president, ever exist in this country. There is no death panel. There is no judgment based on societal productivity. There is no worthiness test. But there is downright evil, and Ms. Palin, you just served its cause. You shouted fire in a crowded theater, a hot theater, and then today tried to roll it back with, no, sorry, not fire, I meant flashlights.
Now we're going to take a fun little detour into the world of wingnut welfare and political nepotism. Don't you just love that sort of thing? But it's related directly to Sarah Palin, because you might remember that before he became Bill Kristol's son-in-law in 2012, a guy named Matthew Continetti was an associate editor at Bill Kristol's Weekly Standard. And thanks to his Weekly Standard contacts, Mr. Continetti got his first book published before he turned 30. The year was 2009. And the title of that book was, quote, The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star, unquote. Scary. So scary. Now, here's the blurb from Britt Hume, who senior political analyst for Fox News. Quote, a compelling account of journalistic malpractice on a grand scale. Those called out in this book should not be allowed to forget what they did. Unquote.
Oh, God.
Yes. Yes.
Britt Hume, of all people.
And I'm sure Britt Hume could just recycle that blurb for any book about how unfair Donald Trump is treated by the liberal media. It really is just a proof of concept for Trump. Yep. That's all Palin was. And all your favorite Never Trump friends are the people that did this to us. So let's not forget that, shall we? This is
And you said, I mean, we're going to title this show, Sarah Palin Walked So Trump Could Run.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. She was the first iteration of this process.
Yeah.
And again, all your favorite Never Trumpers were the people who did this, who plotted this, who made this happen. And you can just take Sarah Palin out of any of these comments practically, plug in Donald Trump, and it's the same goddamn thing. And we were the ones, we liberals were the ones who saw this coming, who warned where this was going, and that were not listened to by anybody who later professed shock that these terrible things were happening to American politics. And this is the back cover summary of that book. Quote, Sarah Palin spent more than a decade making her town and her state better. She slashed government spending and corruption and encouraged economic growth. In 2008, she took to the national stage to bring her successful vision to the entire country. America quickly embraced her message. America? America embraced her message? Sure, okay, whatever. And Palin became the hottest rising star in the country that the country had seen for years, except for, of course, Barack Obama, who became president of the United States, and who was qualified and competent and in every way her opposite. Palin was a strong and popular conservative with traditional values, work, family, and religion, none of which liberals have, of course. And Washington Democrats and their allies in the so-called mainstream media decided she had to be destroyed. These elite liberals attacked everything from Palin's clothing to her parenting style to her church to the fact that she didn't know a fucking thing about anything. No, that was just me adding that in. I apologize. Yeah. They spread one malicious and untrue rumor after another, like she was born in Kenya or had death pan. Oh, I'm sorry. Again, my mistake. The media also treated Palin with such insulting condescension that it frequently lapsed into mockery, unlike, say, Chevy Chase mocking Gerald Ford. Or the entire SNL crew mocking, say, George H.W. Bush or mm-hmm. George Bush. This is how politics and comedy work. But in her case, it was too far. It was too much. They couldn't tolerate this kind of treatment. Palin was routinely ridiculed and vilified, and so was her family. Continuity shows that the liberal media did succeed in one way. They were able to give the election to Barack Obama.
So that election was given to Barack Obama by the media.
It was all, and it's all right there. It's all right there if you just read it. Just read the text. The conspiracy mongering is there. The Republican values versus corrupt Democrat communist Washington values. And of course, the liberal media colluding with Democrats to rob Republicans of their rightful win in 2008 in order to hand the White House to the Kenyan usurper. It's all part of the big George Soros plot, Blue Gal, and everybody knows it.
And it doesn't, you know, it isn't mentioned that Tina Fey often would just repeat verbatim what Sarah Palin said during her SNL skits as Sarah Palin for laughs.
And Tina Fey was interviewed about this, and she said, look, I'm a grown-up. Sarah Palin's a grown-up. We're not fragile. I'm not mocking her. I'm doing comedy. She understands how this works. Again, nobody mocked Chevy Chase when he did Gerald Ford or Bush or anybody. We're not. Why are you making a big deal? This is political comedy. It's been this way forever.
But
of course, you know, their hothouse flower, their precious person couldn't be mocked by the vicious liberals because.
Oh, and mocked by repeating exactly what she had said in interviews.
And then Barack Obama won, which is why all this became
a nightmare. And the media handed that election. It wasn't the voters, right?
No, of course.
This was when the fake Tea Party was reaching full boil, also birtherism.
Mm-hmm.
They were already rage drunk, deluded, and racist. And the election of Barack Obama drove the right completely around the bend. The Republican base lost their damn minds. Here is then CNN contributor David Frum on October 31st, 2011. Quote, a new CNN poll finds that about half of Republicans sympathize with the Tea Party movement. The other half remain either aloof or 5% even express hostility. That second group of Republicans has received remarkably little media attention this cycle. Yet their man, Mitt Romney, has held steady in first or second place the last 3 years. Meanwhile, Tea Party Republicans have bounced from Sarah Palin to Donald Trump.
Yeah, he was on their radar.
To Michelle Bachmann, to Rick Perry, to now Herman Cain. Transfixing the media every time they lose faith in one messiah and search for another. Unquote. The Republican Congress was hunkered down into a reactionary nihilism. They were going to vote no on everything Obama did. And at this point, the trajectory of the Republican Party was clear and unmistakable.
Absolutely. And remember that Frum quote is from 2011 about why isn't anyone paying attention to Mitt Romney? Well, they did. They nominated him and he got crushed by Barack Obama in 2012, which is why they gave up on that wing of the party as perpetual losers and threw in with, hey, Donald Trump, you know, one of their messiahs. This is from the very famous, you probably heard about it, 2012 Washington Post op-ed by Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein. We've talked about this on this podcast a few times. Quote, this is the title, let's just say it, the Republicans are the problem. Note the date, 2012. We have been studying Washington politics and Congress for more than 40 years, and never have we seen them this dysfunctional. In our past writings, we've criticized both parties when we believed it was warranted. Today, however, we have no choice but to acknowledge that the core of the problem lies with the Republican Party. The GOP has become an insurgent outlier in American politics. It is ideologically extreme, scornful of compromise, unmoved by conventional understanding of facts, evidence, and science, and dismissive of the legitimacy of its political opposition. When one party moves this far from the mainstream, it makes it nearly impossible for the political system to deal constructively with the country's challenges. Boy, howdy, is that ever true. In the end, while the press can make certain political choices understandable, it is up to voters to decide. If they can punish ideological extremism at the polls and look skeptically upon candidates who profess to reject all dialogue and bargaining with opponents, then an insurgent outlier party will have some impetus to return to the center. Otherwise, our politics will get worse before it gets better, unquote. And it sure as hell has.
Mm-hmm.
It's much worse now than it was then. And back then it was irreparably bad. After that op-ed, Ornstein and Mann were effectively blacklisted by the rest of the elite political media for telling the simple truth that everyone could see.
Mm-hmm.
The same, I must say, elite political media that had made pariahs out of certain liberal writers who've been writing about the trajectory of the GOP for decades. Didn't want to hear it. Didn't want to hear it. The denial was so deep that 2 years after Mann and Ornstein put the Republican Party's dysfunction on Front Street, this was how most well-known and very serious conservative columnists were still writing about politics. I will give you the quote, Blue Gal. You give me the person and the date. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Quote, every party in opposition goes a little crazy. For Republicans in the early Obama era, insanity took the form of Sarah Palin's spasm. Veteran politicos took the former Alaska governor seriously as a national figure. Republican primary voters nominated the likes of Todd Akin, Christine O'Donnell, and Sharon Angle. Glenn Beck seemed important enough to hold a big rally at the Lincoln Memorial. Fortunately, serious parties eventually pulled back from the fever swamps. That's what's happening to the Republican Party now. Unquote.
Well, that's David Brooks.
Goddamn
sure.
Right, David Brooks. Uh-huh.
And it's after the 2012 midterm sometime.
Oh, it's well after it. This is an op-ed entitled The Governing Party, which is from November 6, 2014, Blue Gal. This is 2.5 years after Mann and Ornstein wrote their column and 7 months before Donald Trump, the king of the birthers, announced that he was running for president of the United States.
Wow. So this was the 2014 midterms.
Yep.
I'm sorry. I said 2012 was not a midterm. That was
no.
Romney. The 2014 Romney. Midterms.
Yeah.
But
you know,
the 2014 party, midterms, David Brooks is writing the Republicans are the governing party.
Yeah. They're getting back to it. They went a little crazy,
and
but
the fever's
don't worry.
Breaking. The fever's breaking. It's going to be Rubio.
It's going to be Rubio. And that's how a lot of conservative columns were writing. Stop panicking. Everything's fine. We have everything under control.
Yeah. It's going to be Jeb or Rubio.
Yep.
So to wind things down on this podcast, we're going to jump back in time a little bit to this article by David Johnson in the Huffington Post, which is no longer up, from July 4th, 2009. But we found it in the Driftglass blog.
Yeah. Archives, baby. Archives.
Archives. Entitled, We Don't Need No Stinkin' Governing. Quote, people need to understand that in Republican circles, resigning as governor does not harm Sarah Palin's career. And this was when the summer of 2009 is when she resigned as governor of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to the article, being a governor is just governing. And Republicans don't do that. In fact, there is a contempt for the idea. And Palin has just reinforced her brand as one with contempt for government. The very word governor is suspect to them. The only use of the job is to affect redistricting so Republicans can have more power and to keep a state from spending, also known as providing services to the citizens, and especially from asking the rich or corporations to pay any taxes for their use of the infrastructure the rest of us built, unquote. And when I read that, I think so much of Carrie Lake. Having a governor jacket after she lost.
Yeah.
Because she didn't want to govern the state of Arizona.
No.
She didn't. All she wanted to do was have more power for Republicans.
Yeah.
And she can do that by simply bitching about the election and pretending to be governor.
And you can see that. You can see that in some Republicans now, you know, the ones who've fallen from favor with the party, the few, and a lot of pundits saying, you know, secretly, Republicans just want to be in the minority again.
Yeah.
They don't want to have to govern. They don't want to have to make decisions. They want
they don't
to sit
have
on
to
the
write
sidelines.
Right.
No, I want to sit on the sidelines and bitch about Democrats and how awful they are and snipe at them and sabotage them. But I don't want to take any blame or responsibility for anything I do because I have no idea how to do anything. It's a party of bigots and imbeciles, and it's reflected in their policy priorities, which are nil, and the candidates they put up who are crazy. Now, I'm going to take a little personal privilege here because this was me writing in July of 2009, reacting to that Huffington Post column you just heard.
I just want to tell you something, Jeff Glass. That's 15 years ago.
I know. It's 15 years ago. Believe me, I feel every one of those in my bones. But I married the right woman, and that has made my dotage tolerable, let me just say. And in my post, I'm talking about Sarah Palin, but other than my reference to fuck me pumps, I believe it very accurately describes the direction the base of the GOP was going and what that base really wanted, clearly visible to those of us who were paying attention 15 plus years ago. Okay, this is me from way back when. Quote, when you begin with a movement that was already stocked to the rafters with goofs and bigots 30 years ago, and then plot the trend lines of their radical, Yahoo, anarchic, branch perfidian cult to its logical conclusion, you cannot help but notice that they all seem to intersect at a point in the near future, occupied by something that looks a lot like Sarah Palin. A perky, Fox TV camera-friendly, brown shirt in bright red fuck-me pumps who didn't so much resign from the governor's office as she contemptuously resigned from the very concept of government itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so liberated from the need to meet even the most minimal requirements of democratic government, from the mundane need to propose policy, solve real problems, or know what the fuck she's talking about, Palin is now free to finish the project begun by Rush Limbaugh over 20 years ago, to reduce the existential distance between hate radio and the Republican Party to zero.
Yep.
To mutate into a being of pure media. A sylph dispensing Delphic fortune cookies pasted together from flag pins, bumper stickers, and scriptural confetti. A wingnut elemental. A granter of plutocrat wishes and the fulfiller of imbecile dreams. Unquote. That's me 15 years ago.
In 2008, pundits called what had gone wrong with the Republican Party Palinism. But they had called the same disease Trumpism after Palin, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And before that, they'd call it Tom DeLayism. That was before Palin. And before Tom DeLay, they called it Gingrichism. It's not any of these isms. Remember, don't you dare call it Trumpism.
That was you.
That was me. In the summer of 2016, before mm-hmm. Donald Trump won and surprised everybody,
that's right.
I was saying, this isn't, the media was doing all this. What about Trumpism? Trumpism this, Trumpism that. No. The truth is, the problem with the modern Republican Party has always been that it's full of Republicans. And this is something the media doesn't want to talk about.
No.
Because they have to sell dick pills to Republicans.
Right.
So they don't want to tell them they're shitheads. They don't want to tell them they don't know anything about governing. The problem with the modern Republican Party is Republicanism. And that is anti-government. That is anti-governing.
Right. Anti-democratic.
And it's a disaster for the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, all of those auditioning for Trump's vice presidential slot have been following the Palin model to the letter. It's like a jello mold.
Right.
Not only Carrie Lake and Kristi Noem and Elise Stefanik, but also Tim Scott and J.D. Vance.
Yeah. Vivek Ramaswamy. I mean, he
Vivek Ramaswamy.
Yeah.
They're all following this know-nothing, you know, total devotion to ideology, whatever it is, with no actual facts to back it up.
Slandering, casually slandering and demonizing Democrats all along the way.
All
it's not my opponents. It's not I disagree with their policy. It's they're evil people. They want to kill babies. I remember Palin saying something about, you know, being a small town mayor is kind of like being a community organizer, except you have to actually do work, you know?
Right, right.
That was her shot at Barack Obama, which was just pathetic. I mean,
but she's got this legacy, and everyone who wants to be in Trump's circle these days and get favor from him is following her legacy. Now, we're going to riff a little bit. The one thing I want to make sure we tell our listeners, Driftglass, is to go back, if you want to spend some time in real time experiencing what it was like to be around when Sarah Palin was doing all of this, we have podcasts.
Yes, we do.
We've been podcasting since 2010.
Right.
So we have a number, especially in the early days before we started numbering our podcasts. Uh-huh. And I can't guarantee the sound quality is all that great. There's a lot of giggling.
Yeah, well.
Driftglass and I were doing a lot of podcasts, especially in 2010, about Sarah Palin.
Yep.
Because it was thought that she might be the nominee in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I brought up in one of our podcasts, because I went back and listened to a couple of them, was that she was too independent, that she couldn't be corralled.
That's right.
By the RNC into doing what they were going to tell her to do, which is study, write some white papers on energy.
Nope.
Get some debate skills. Mm-hmm. Do your homework. And this was something Bill O'Reilly was telling her to do on the air and saying, you will be the presidential nominee in 2012 if you just sit down and read a book.
Do the work. Do the work. Yeah. I do recall in that movie, Game Change,
mm-hmm.
There's a scene of several scenes of Republican aides trying to educate her about mm-hmm. how, you know.
Well, it's Nicole Wallace is on the team. And Steve Schmidt are trying to just get her to speak in complete sentences. Yeah.
And here are our allies. And here's what World War II was. And here's why it was bad. Mm-hmm. And she's just completely ignorant of everything. She doesn't mm-hmm. know shit about anything. And she's like writing stuff down and taking notes. And honey, it is 20, 30 years too late for you to catch up. At mm-hmm. this level, you know, pick mm-hmm. a few topics. And she just wouldn't do it. She did not want to go back to Alaska. Remember, she wanted to give her own resignation, her own speech at the...
own speech at the convention. Yeah.
Yeah. No, her own speech
at the election. At the election. Yep. Yeah. She wanted to give a concession speech to Barack Obama. Yes. Yeah.
And Steve Schmidt and others braced her and said, that is not how this works. Well, I'm going to go out there and give my own concession speech, because she thought, look, John McCain's the loser here. John McCain is the loser. I'm the winner. I'm the future. Yeah. And she was like, I don't want to go back to Alaska. I don't want to go back to fucking Wasilla. Mm-hmm. I want to stay in Washington, New York and shop and live this life. Mm-hmm. You have shown me this glamorous life where people buy me things and they treat me well and they put me on TV.
And I get to stay in nice hotels. Yeah.
I don't want to go back to Alaska. Are you fucking crazy? And the Republican Party could not convince her to just do the basic work of reading stuff about the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, they still thought that was important.
Right. And what was really important was her toenail polish.
That's right.
That's exactly what the media and what the base wanted to know about.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And it turned into Trump.
Yes, absolutely.
Nobody cares about his toenail polish, but he lumbered down the escalator and started talking about Mexicans are rapists and murderers. John mm-hmm. McCain was a loser. And the base was like, thank God, somebody finally is telling us. And by the way, the Iraq war was a disaster. George Bush lied us into it.
Yeah.
Thus letting the entire base off the hook.
Because
it wasn't their fault. It wasn't their fault. It was Bush's fault. And you're going to run his brother for president? Are you crazy? No, this was coming, as we used to say in Chicago. Yeah. You could see this coming down Michigan Avenue a mile away. This was exactly where the party was headed. And the fact that the people who called it and saw it and warned about it are all still pariahs in the media. And the people that caused it and greased the skids for it have all been forgiven, because we're all broken and fallen people. And they've all had their – Bill Kristol is the leader of the pack, but they've all had their media careers saved. David Frum is back in the mix. He's over at the Atlantic. All the people who fucked up all protect each other and all rehabilitate each other's career, which is how something like Palin can happen.
Yep.
Because
it's how Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert happened.
Exactly.
And you see them show up on the House floor with a bill that's mm-hmm. going to, you know, cut IRS salaries to $1 a year or whatever, or doing something, trying to commit to something, not just cutting salaries, but trying to commit to something. And Steny Hoyer, of all people, having a field day with them because there's nothing in the bill that funds what they want to do.
Right.
They don't know how to write a bill, and they would not go to bill writing class, which is provided, by the way.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
During the transition, you are taught how to do these things.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hire. I mean, this is the thing. Sarah Palin could have hired a staff in 2010
uh-huh.
to prepare her over and over again for the presidency. But she had no interest in governing.
No.
She had no interest in doing anything but spouting and being treated to things.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Donald Trump. The only thing is Donald Trump also is a criminal.
Well,
and yeah,
and he was also is also already a celebrity.
He was
already well known, had a face, and
being in charge on The Apprentice. Right. You know, he's got leadership skills. Right.
The Republican Party had been sniffing around him years before, so he'd already been on their radar. And at that point, people like Steve Bannon read the same room we did, Blue Gal, and said, okay, here's how you can win. This is how you can win. You got to go in strong. You got to go in like an asshole. You got to take no prisoners. You have to tell people the base. Fuck all these consultants and all these people tugging at your corner.
And fuck Jeb Bush, too. Fuck the whole Bush family.
The whole Bush family.
Because we hate them.
The Bill Kristols and the David Brookses of the world are nobody. Yeah. They're nothing.
Well, this is what Steve Bannon understands about the Republican base.
Right.
It's how violent and racist and know nothing they are.
Yeah.
And how to talk to them.
And so you tell your candidate, ignore all the neoconservative dregs of the Bush administration, because they'll only drag you down and try to turn you into one of them. And go out there and talk to the base like Rush Limbaugh talks to him.
Right.
You know how Rush talks.
And Sean Hannity.
And Sean Hannity.
Talk to Sean Hannity every night. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And this is, you know, there's a famous Twilight Zone episode with Dennis Hopper, who's being taught how to be Hitler. You know, there's a creature
That's
in the shadows. And this creature in the shadows turns out to be Hitler's ghost. And it's all about how do you get the mob on your side? And it's you become one of them. Their problems become your problems. Their hatreds become your hate. You absorb all of their bigotry and all their rage and all their, and you reflect it back to them. And that is exactly what Trump did, only by doing what Limbaugh had been doing for 30 years, speaking to them in the language that Limbaugh spoke to them for 30 years. And the fact that the entire elite conservative establishment depended on those people and depended on Limbaugh delivering them and refused to acknowledge that that was real and refused to treat them seriously was how Trump was able to run right up the middle and take the party, because the party was there for the taking. Now, one more thing that's very important to remember about this period and the moment we're in now is, don't forget, we really need more Patreons to make this podcast fly. So if you can spare $5, please spare $5 and visit our Patreon at patreon.com/proleftpod. And thank you for doing that.
And if you haven't done that already and you've enjoyed this show and listened to all 55 minutes of it.
Yeah.
And you haven't donated 50 cents a show. We appreciate those of you that are in the military. You're off the hook. If you're active military, this is our gift to you.
If you're strapped, you're off the hook.
If you're on disability, this is our gift to you.
Yeah.
If you go on vacation.
Look, if I had an entire publishing industry and a father-in-law that would get my Persecuting Sarah Palin book published, I wouldn't be asking you for money. I really wouldn't. I would go, because I'm already taken care of. I'm flush because my daddy-in-law runs the Weekly Standard, and I can get any goddamn book
I
want.
You can have an ad-free podcast for nothing.
Sure, absolutely. But we don't really have that. What we have is you guys. And boy, do we appreciate the fact that you're out there
really
supporting
do.
Us. It really does get us up in the morning and get us going. So
thank you so much for that. And we'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time.
The Professional Left Podcast, No Fair Remembering Stuff Tuesday edition, is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2024-25, DGBG Productions.